everyone, to another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that tells you like it is. And this is our first podcast of the new year. Kind of took some time off during the holidays, simply because people have enough to do during the holidays without trying to keep up with podcasts. So, you know, there's a lot going on, and a lot going on for me, so now we can kind of get back to it. And I'd just like to remind you, because it's been so long, hey, we kind of do three different portions of this podcast. The first is talking about general politics, kind of the atmospherics of what's going on, and a couple of the select things that are happening. The next I like to do are critiques of some of the gun culture creations that are out there, whether it's on YouTube or blogs or whatever else, or whatever kind of Second Amendment stuff, gun stuff comes up that's interesting. And then the third is my favorite, questions and answers, because there's always some very interesting question and, you know, got to think to give an answer. And I like answers. Answers are opinion and people can agree or disagree. Okay, so let's get into a couple of top stories. The first one is one of my favorite things. We've been talking about, hey, this impeachment is dead. It is DOA. It is dead on arrival. There's no way that every day this drags on, people are taking it less seriously. If the Democrats were smart, which they're not, they would have immediately sent this thing over to the Senate, let whatever happens, happens, and go. But instead, they're trying to leverage, and people are just radically losing interest. They think it's BS, they know it's BS, and they're radically losing interest. In fact, I'm starting to think now there may not even be a Senate trial. There may not. First of all, they may never send it over to them. Or the Senate could, on a majority vote, I suppose, pass a resolution or an amendment or something saying that, hey, we're not going to listen to this. It's been too long. It's obviously political. We're not even going to entertain this. So have a nice day. So that's probably what's going to happen with that. But it is funny watching the little camera hogs, Pelosi, Schiff, who's a dolt guy, Nadler, yeah, Nadler, you know, weebles wobble, but they don't fall down, that guy, you know, watching that parade and cast of characters, parade of fools, you know, everybody's done with it now, everybody's done, and they're moving on, and so those guys, if they keep beating the drum for this, they are running the risk of paying a horrific price in the fall. I think there's an actual chance that the Republicans could win back the House, and I think it's a very, very strong bet that they're going to retain the White House. I think this has just made Trump stronger. In the words of Admiral Yamamoto, the words that are always attributed to him, you know, they have awakened a sleeping giant and filled him with a terrible resolve. And they've done it just in time for 2020. Yeah, that was really smart strategy on their parts. Now, we got some great piece of news. This guy, Soleimani, or whatever his name was, Soleimani or whatever, this is some terrorist that the Iranians called a general. This guy flew into Baghdad, thinks he's going to, you know, kind of be the rock star and have a, you know, set himself up at the old Baghdad International Airport, a place that most of us who went over there know quite well. And, you know, he's going to run his little terrorist operations, going to mess with the embassy and do all this other stuff. Well, you know what? Guess what? He got a visit, and he got a visit from a drone, and he's not here anymore. And, you know, it's amazing how the news media says, oh, what's Iran going to do next? Hey, Iran better be looking over their shoulders. All those people, if they make a single move, they're going to pay. They're going to pay heavy. I mean, we can exact a real cost. Most terrorist organizations, like Al-Qaeda and all these other ones, you know, they usually operate underground. They don't have any terrain. They have no infrastructure to hit. But if you're Iran, you're an actual country. You're not a non-state player. You are a state player. And you've got a lot of vulnerabilities. I mean, we have the ability to quite easily shoot down their Air Force, sink their Navy, and do all kinds of other bad things to them. So they better look around, look over their shoulders, and think very, very carefully. The only reason they've been able to get away with it is because The Bushes, the Clintons, the Obamas, the Clintons, the Bushes, all those, you know, it just kind of lose track. Our policy has been kind of tolerate them, kind of this bogus containment policy we always have towards these countries. North Korea used to be Iraq before the invasion, Iran, the old Soviet Union, Cuba. We try to contain these things, you know, just put enough military around them, keep watch on them. And these guys always pull some shenanigans. They attack ships and aircraft, or in the case of Iran, they overran the embassy, kept hostages for over a year. You know, and we always just kind of, you know, just let it slide, let it go. Well, those days are gone. And when they try this stuff, they're going to pay. And they better get used to paying a price, because that's what's going to happen. Okay, some other cool things, getting kind of into the gun culture part of this. Hey, gun rights are on the move. And I mean, you know, I've been waiting a long time for this. I always hate it that, you know, it always seems the gun controllers have the initiative. You know, they start the law, they get the drumbeat of the media behind it, where everything's overreported, you know, and it's, well, there was a two-year-old who may have been injured by a gun in Bangor, Maine, you know, and that's national news. So they're always on the initiative. They report everything as national news. Then they get the usual idiot legislators to introduce something, and they try to take, you know, Second Amendment rights away from millions and millions of people based on very isolated cases. So gun rights are really on the move, and Virginia will show you that. Virginia is the flashpoint. All those Second Amendment sanctuary counties, that's a big deal, and people are noticing. And I would say no matter where you are, push on your local elected officials to do the same thing. Become, even in California, become a Second Amendment sanctuary county or city or even small town. You know, you can do this. And you get enough of them, like the entire state of Virginia, and people are going to notice. You notice that that racist governor and his sex offender lieutenant governor, those guys are backing off, because even their state National Guard basically said, hey, we're not going to do this, because that's just the way that goes. They can't use those guys against their own people, against their own families. It's not going to work. It's never worked, and it won't work now. So gun rights are on the move, but become the sanctuary. Socialize that idea with local. Put some power back into some local officials. You know, it's about time that we are stopped being dictated to, and we kind of define the rules of the game. So I think that's very, very good. In 2020, you know, has the potential to be a great year for gun owners, especially if the House comes away from the Democrats, Donald Trump is reelected, and people push on local and state levels, pro-gun candidates, 2020 could be a very, very good year. Okay, another great piece of news. Everybody knows the Texas church shooting. It's too bad that even with the very, very quick, almost lightning reaction time that happened in that church, that two of the parishioners were murdered. That is too bad. It would have been great if those two lives had not been lost. But you know, the potential was there were a whole bunch of other people who were going to be killed. The potential for that to have turned into just a mass tragedy is just there. However, one guy with one shot, he ended it right then and there. And he was the perfect guy. You know, he was a firearms instructor, former FBI, they said. This guy knew what he was doing and everything else. And he is not really representative of the average CCW carrier. But he was the guy who was at the right place at the right time. You know, I think people, well, first of all, I would tell you that regardless of race, religion, anything else, that my people are gun people. I don't care about any of the rest of it. If you're a gun person, you are one of my people, and it's just like being in the same religion or all that stuff, you know, is to other people, well, the gun culture is to me. And I just want to, you know, I can't understand why there are still large public gatherings of vulnerable populations who don't see fit to protect themselves. To my mind, you're crazy if you are going to synagogue and your synagogue has no security. In this day and age, I'm sorry, it's just some of the people we've let into the country. It's some of the attitudes that people have had. You're not completely safe, and you cannot count on the goodwill of others. You have to protect yourselves. Same thing with churches, same thing with the rest of it. No matter really what you're doing, there has to be a security plan. When you're planning an event, you need a security plan. Just that simple. So I hope people take that to heart and kind of start doing it. We're seeing it more and more, but it needs to be a whole lot bigger. You know, they don't hold professional football games without a security plan. They don't hold a lot of these big events without a security plan. So even on a small level, where there's people who are gathering, you need to have a security plan. And that security plan means armed responders, more than a radio, more than just bear spray. You've got to have an armed responder who can do exactly what that man in Texas did, or at least get close to that level of performance where somebody can come in, everybody can draw guns and basically put the guy under fire, the bad guy under fire, and take him out. So that those are two good news stories as far as guns and gun rights go. Another one that was a lot of fun is, you know, InRange TV finally decided to have some fun, and they had a 007 shoot one of their videos. It was a one of their normal matches where, you know, some of the guys, I guess, dressed like 007 in formal attire and used 007 types of what they consider to be 007 types of weapons. It would have been a little more fun had they had some of the other competitors who did it too. I don't know how much participation they really had, but it would have been fun to see some of the other choices. But at least it shows them that they can have fun, have a little holiday spirit, and kind of go with that. So that's all okay. Another thing I saw, and I don't even know how old this thing was. I actually was laughing so hard I had to stop. With some one of these guys, content creators, talking about how crummy the B-27 target is. And you know, the B-27 target is that, you know, usual kind of silhouette. It's kind of like the almost the paper kind of a paper rendition of what an E-type military E-type silhouette looks like. Outline of a person from the lower waist up with arms at the side, and you don't really see hands or anything. It's just that kind of a silhouette. Those have been in use for years and years and years, and his dealio on that was that the scoring rings are too low, so you're shooting into the abdomen and middle chest when everybody knows you need to hit into the upper chest, and blah 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 blah. Of course, what he's completely ignoring is the fact that, you know, when you shoot center mass at a target, and the scoring rings on a B-27 are located approximately what we would call center mass. That when you're actually, and you know, the B-27 is a good rifle target too. It's a really good rifle target for the same reasons. You know, when you're shooting center mass, some of your bullets might go low, some of your bullets might go high, but the good part about that is that if you miss high or low or slightly to the left or slightly to the right, you know, the bullet is going to hit that torso and hopefully you'll have some effect on it. You know, sometimes you can fire and there's no seem the bullets seemingly have no effect. Other times you can get a one shot stop. How about that? So, you know, the B-27 is not a bad target because they're always going to be that spread of shots. You know, they're always going to have that. And I would say it's just been, unless the gun is really got problems with its sights, almost everyone shoots a little bit high. So, You know, if people, when they miss, they rarely miss low. It's not like, hey, I see a bad guy and I shoot and, hey, my bullet hits the dirt. A lot of times it's they kind of rise because they're healing the gun or whatever the reason is. They're anticipating recoil and kind of pushing on the gun a little bit. The bullets can go high. And so if that happens, hey, they're right in where this guy said they should be. So there is no problem using a B-27. So I kind of repeat the warning I give people. Don't believe everything you see on YouTube and on the internet. And I think there's just somebody, there are a lot of guys who are just trying to create a lot of content. And you know, some of the things that they do just kind of come out a little bit silly. You know, training on a B-27, no matter where the scoring rings are, is better than training on, I think, a circular target. I think it's better. You know, the USPSA and IDP, they have targets that are used, and they're good targets. They're good targets. And definitely you can train on those. I always, to be blunt, when I train with a B-27, sometimes I use the scoring rings if I can see them, but a lot of times I take one of those orange peel-off dots that I think it's Birchwood Casey or somebody makes. And you can put that anywhere on the target you want. You can put it up a little higher on the chest if that's, you know, where you want to use and get used to the aiming point. That's no problem. You know, you don't really have to use the scoring rings. The value of the B-27 to me has always been the silhouette shape because it's very similar to an Army E-type silhouette, which I've described just a few minutes ago. And that is a good target to shoot at. It's the paper, kind of the paper copy of that target. And you can actually get kind of a, it's really more of a modified B-27. They don't call it that, but there's a couple of places, and I get mine from pistolier.com, PISTOLEER.com. You can actually get the paper Army M9 targets, which are essentially the same thing, effectively the same thing, and a good target. The reason I don't really care for those is I don't really like a black target if I'm using a service style gun because a lot of times you can just lose that front sight in there and you just don't know where it is. The B-27s that I like are, you can get them in different colors. You can get them in light blue. Green is my favorite. That looks to me to be the most realistic, that it's not black, if you don't lose your sights on it. So I like the green target the best, but you can get them in any and a variety of colors, and they're all pretty good. You won't lose that front sight. Now, if you think you're going to be shooting at a lot of dark targets or targets that are in dark clothing, then that's probably a good indicator to you that you need to, at the very least, the very, very least, get some tester's paint and paint your front sight a color that will stand out against that black background. But for most of us, that's not a real problem. So anyway, that's the B-27 deal. And now, hey, a little bit early, we have gotten into my favorite part of the podcast, which is questions and answers. And got some interesting ones today. And the first one is, what do you think of Colt returning the famed and storied Python revolver to production? And I get asked this because for some reason, people like to ask me about pythons. I do have a python that I got back in the 80s, and I just love it. It's kind of like a Rolex watch, you know. It's just a very, very nice, very, very nice revolver. What do I think about them reintroducing it? Well, I think, first of all, it's obviously an admission that it was a mistake to stop producing it, which they did back in 2002 or 2003, I guess. So they're rectifying that mistake. And Colt is at least recognizing it in this case. They've brought back the kind of a target version, the King Cobra, which, you know, that was, there's a lot of people who like nice revolvers, especially accurate revolvers and powerful revolvers. There's still a big following for that. You know, they sell a lot of them. There are a lot of those guns are sold. So at least this is one which, unlike the AR-15 market or the Colt single action market or the 1911 market, three markets the Colt has thrown away, which arguably are three of the largest gun markets in the country. I mean, you know, you can talk about the number of single action guns sold, whether that's a significant amount or not, but it's obviously been keeping Uberti and Ruger and a few other people been very lucrative for them. So, but Colt threw that away. Colt threw away the AR-15 market. If they'd marketed that thing heavily back in the 1970s and 80s, they would be at the king of the hill. They would be dominating this extremely popular market today. And of course, the 1911 market, Colt still makes some 1911 somewhere. But you know, if you bring up 1911 or 1911 A1, you don't really find Colt. You find everybody else with capacity is making them. Everybody. So everybody makes a 1911 style handgun and in 45 ACP. But Colt, at one point, was the only game in town and owned that market. But they didn't change, they didn't develop it, they didn't advertise, they didn't build the kind of loyalty that could have kept them. They should be the most profitable gun company in history. I don't know why I'm stuttering a little bit today. I guess it's still part of the holiday hangover. But they should be the wealthiest, largest, and most profitable gun company in history. But instead, they struggle. And there's always seem to be on the verge of reorganizing or bankruptcy. But I hope, and I'm sure that they've done some marketing analysis linked to the Grateful Dead, not the Grateful Dead, the Walking Dead. The Walking Dead. They're a lot, yeah, I like them a lot better than the Grateful Dead, as a matter of fact. But the Walking Dead has made the Python kind of this very, very cool thing. And prices have just skyrocketed. I saw kind of a ratty one that, you know, they were asking $2,000 for it at a local gun shop. You know, that's whether they would take less or not, I don't know. I don't really waste somebody's time negotiating price over a gun I have no intention of buying. But I assume if it had $2,000 on it, they would probably take $1,800, but that's still a huge chunk of change for a gun that really was not in that nice a condition. For a Python, you think of the Python as the royal blue finish and being nearly perfect. So you know, that's kind of where I'm at with that. I think it's a good marketing idea. I think it's going to be a very expensive gun, which actually I'm this is one of the few guns I like seeing as expensive, because my fear is when I first heard that it was coming back, I said, oh my God, this is going to be something that looks like a Python, but the insides are going to be like a Taurus Tracker. You know, they're going to be cheaped out on the inside, kind of okay on the outside, and they're going to be selling it at a price point so that a lot of people can grab them up right now. But it's coming out at $1,500, $1,499 MSRP. I imagine on the street you might find them for a little bit less. Not much, but a little bit less. But that's still a pretty heavy price, and so I'm hoping that that means that there'll be some extra attention put into the fit and finish of those guns. Now, if they're really smart, if they're really, really smart, they'll also bring out the Python in 38 Special with the appropriate length chambers and maybe a little bit more optimized barrel twist, rifling twist, for the 38 Special cartridge. And I say that because the Python, at least my experience with them, they shoot magnums, 357 magnums, unbelievably accurate. They're excellent accuracy, just absolutely the best. The 38 Specials, they're okay, but they're not going to keep up with a Smith & Wesson Model 14. They're not going to keep up, you know, the Target Masterpiece, they called it, the Model 14. They're not going to keep up with that. They're not going to keep up with a really good quality 38 Special Target revolver. But they'll shoot them okay. But I think for people, there is a market for the 38 Special to essentially kind of come back as a very, very fun cartridge to use at ranges. And do a lot of things, especially for stuff that because people want to have a gun like the one that's on the Walking Dead. So, and maybe the Grateful Dead likes them too. There's still a few of those guys around. Maybe they like them too. I don't know. So that's what I think of the Colt Python returning. And I'm actually glad to see it. I like seeing quality guns in the marketplace. Same thing about the SIG Neuhausen, the P210 that's now kind of U.S. made and on the market. Haven't checked one out yet. Would like to. I think they kind of come in. I'm doing a little bit of research. They come in two guises, kind of a service grade that's got fixed sights and a target grade that's got an adjustable sight and a few hundred dollars difference. But it's nice to see quality guns kind of coming back, you know, on some level. After all, this is called old school guns, you know, and so here we are in the 54th episode, and it's awful nice to see, you know, some of these guns coming back. Also notice, you know, Ruger is, for a couple years now, they've put out kind of a 38 target revolver. I forget which model it is, but you know, there's a lot of that stuff that had, there's goodness in all of that. There's goodness in very accurate guns. And I'm glad to see that on some levels, they're still hanging around. Okay, where can I get good quality U.S. military style leather holsters? Okay, I know two answers to this. The first answer is there's a place called World War Supply, and for Christmas, Santa Claus gave me one of their M7 shoulder holsters, which I'm very impressed with. Very, very, very impressed with. Excellent quality, good thick leather, finished very nice, kind of that nice russet look, you know, really nice. Not that some of them come with just bare leather, you know, and I guess you're supposed to dye them yourself or whatever. But be that as it may, this came very, very nice, very, very well finished. Appears to be very well made. Really like it. Nice, thick leather. I think they make it for other U.S. military handguns besides the 1911. I think you can get some hip holsters and a few things for some of the U.S. military revolvers like the 4-inch Smith & Wesson, Colt and Smith & Wesson 1917s. You can kind of get those. I think they have one for the Colt 1903 because that was the 1903 automatic, because that was used by the U.S. military on a couple levels. So, you know, you can kind of get that stuff there. That's off the shelf. It is what it is. And those things are pretty attractively priced. If I remember right, those things are between, you know, $40 and $60, depending on how that all works. But you go to World War Supply, whatever their website is, and they've got it. Now, if you want a U.S. military style holster for a gun that's not quite or exactly in the configuration of a U.S. military gun, I know that El Paso Saddlery can sell you the different kind of holsters for some of the different firearms. So you can get, you know, like the old holster we always used to use with the 1911s, the model 1916 holster, you know, the flap holster. I think you can get that for even some revolvers and a few things, some commercially made guns that obviously that holster was never made for. It will cost you some money. They do have a lead time, and they kind of make them on a custom basis, so it's not like they got a lot of them sitting on the shelf. So, like for me, I got a Patton, I think it was called the Patton number 5 holster, but I got it for a Ruger Blackhawk. Now, obviously, General Patton never had a Ruger Blackhawk, but they will make that style holster for, you know, kind of a similar single-action gun. You know, even though the frame of the Ruger Blackhawk is a little different and everything, they basically make it to the specs of the new gun. So, you know, and it's very good, but you do have to wait for it. There are probably some other people out there, but those are the two that kind of come to my my mind. Why are those kind of holsters popular? Well, people like the tradition. People kind of like saying, hey, this is, I kind of like saying, hey, this is the same kind of holster Patton had, and kind of checking it out and see if I like it or not. And I do find the design to be very, very good. Plus, there's another fact that flap holsters are just darn good holsters. They are not good for CCW. They are not good if you're a cop on the street and may have to draw your gun very, very quickly. They're not good for that. They are century old and even older technology, but they do protect the gun very, very well. So if you're a person that goes out into the field and you could get caught in a rain squall or something else, you could definitely use it. And frankly, they're not that bad. I mean, you can draw from them. You can do things. Concealed is a problem, but on the belt, it is a little slower, but it is a good, secure way to carry a handgun, and it does protect the handgun. And a lot of people like that. That's very convenient to a lot of people. So those are great holsters, two good makers, and, you know, whatever your budget will bear. Okay, here is the next question. Do you have a favorite bullpup rifle? If so, what is it? Well, I don't have a favorite bullpup rifle because I think they're all junky. There are a couple different kinds of bullpups. Some are designed from the ground up to be bullpups, and that's things like the Tavor, and I suppose there are some others. There are another class of rifles that are kind of converted to be bullpups. And I think actually Valmet made one, which was kind of an AK bullpup. There have been several different kinds over the years where they basically, and actually you could even buy the parts and do this yourself, where you put a Ruger Mini 14 action into a bullpup type stock, and it's got the trigger linkages and all the rest of it. And that's the inherent problem. There's a couple of inherent problems. Number one, what made the bullpup obsolete is our old friend the AR-15 with the collapsible stock. I mean, the advantages you get with a bullpup rifle, which is the very, very short overall length, in order to get that, you give up a lot of things. One of them is a good trigger. Another one is the ability to perform immediate action very quickly on a jammed or malfunctioned weapon. The next thing that you tend to lose is the ability to bring it up very quickly, and then if you have to shoot from the opposite shoulder, if it's configured for a right-handed person and you shoot it from your weak side, you're going to eat a lot of brass. You're going to eat it. You know, that's just the way that's designed, because the action is in the back of the stock, and that's just where it is. You're either going to eat brass, or you're going to bump. It's going to fly into you and bump back into the chamber and cause a jam, which you've got to unjam. So you lose a lot with a bullpup design. And I've already mentioned it. You lose a good trigger. You know, the trigger, because it has to have these long linkages now to actuate and do all the things that a trigger needs to do, it's going to have a lot of mechanical creep, a lot of mechanical tolerances and things. It's going to be heavier. It's got a whole litany of problems, which is why bullpups, you never really see a bullpup sniper rifle. You really don't see that, because the trigger, to get the trigger to the right level of performance, is very, very difficult when you've got all these long things. It's got a long way in between the trigger and the action. That's a bad thing. Normally you want a very, very short distance, and you want it very efficient, so you have a very, very fast lock time, and thus the rifle has the potential to be a lot more accurate. So I don't like them for any of those reasons. And the last reason, the last thing is, how many have really been adopted for military service? I can think of the FAMAS. I know in the 50s the British were flirting with it, until they were forced by the evil United States and NATO to abandon that and go with the 7.62x51 NATO cartridge, and that kind of meant they had to go with the SLR, the British version of the FNFAL rifle. But, you know, it didn't take a whole lot of convincing for the British to dump that bullpup idea. You know, once you get past the G. Willikers, this is very cool portion of that, and you start seeing the debits, and you actually start handling those things. The short overall length is very, very impressive and very nice. However, I think that the things you have to give up to get that are just too great. And even the Steyr-AUG, which, you know, if the bullpup design was superior and was the way forward, the Steyr-AUG would have made everything obsolete 35 years ago, or even longer, 30 or 40 years ago when it first came out. Instead, it's been adopted by a few people, and, you know, time has just kind of passed it by. And so that's why I don't like bullpups. I don't really find any practical reason for them. The civilian-made bullpups, the Desert Tech, and some of these other ones, they're a joke. They're a non-military military rifle. No one has adopted them, and there's a reason for that. No one will adopt them. There's a reason for that. It's just not going to be efficient. It's just not going to be, and it hasn't had the development that the ARs have. And face it, the AR collapsing stock is now the standard. I mean, and you can get a very short overall length if you have a 14.5 barrel and collapsing stock. That is a very, very small package, and it's so quick to pop that thing out a couple of clicks and get a good stock weld and start shooting that it really does handle a lot better than the bullpups. So that's, I don't have a favorite one. I don't like them. I think they're just a design dead end. They keep coming back to life every few years, but they're a design dead end, and they're going nowhere. All right. Let me see. Here's the next question. Are there any weapons available to civilians, and that's important, available to civilians, which can stop a vehicle carrying a bomb or other explosive or creating a hazard? And I think this question is in kind of thinking the lines of, hey, a terrorist attack, somebody gets a car and they, you know, you see it revving down the street, it's broken through a barricade, it's headed towards a crowd. What kind of weapon can stop that? And the answer I will say is there's not a lot of good options. The best options to stop that are barriers, you know, big Jersey bounce barriers that cannot break through, or the, you know, the barrels filled with concrete that are going to slow it down. Small arms, it's very difficult to stop a moving car. And in fact, in Iraq, we found that 5.56, even out of the M249 saw, cars can just soak that up. Yes, eventually they may stop, but really, the you know, if you're hitting the engine compartment and all the running gear, they can absorb a lot of punishment and just keep going, at least until their intended target. Even if you kill the driver, sometimes the inertia can get it to its target to detonate. So my experience with that would be the most effective weapons were 7.62 by 51 NATO, you know, general purpose machine guns, M240, the M60 could do the same thing. You know, basically they can deliver punishment. Of course, the M250 caliber, or now I guess they're M2A1s because they're fitting them with fixed headspace. Of course, that is going to be able to punish a civilian vehicle and definitely be able to inflict serious damage on it and can help stop it. But, you know, once you get a 2,000-pound machine moving at 20 or 30 miles an hour, there's really not very much that's in civilian hands that can stop it or push it backwards. They're just not going to happen. So, you know, I would say that if you're faced with that kind of situation, the best thing to do is concentrate fire on the driver's compartment and put enough barriers in to prevent the vehicle from moving. You know, there could be some interesting other means. You know, what if you had a Mark 19 grenade launcher that had great big paintball rounds and you hit the windshield with goo that they can't see through? Well, then they're going to lose all their spatial awareness. And so, you know, that's one way that you could do that. Other ways would be, you know, again, using the conventional highway patrol things of the spike strips and other things that will stop a vehicle. But there's very little you can launch out of a weapon that would really stop it. You know, you really kind of have to start looking at like recoilless rifles with canister shot or something like that that might be able to inflict enough damage quickly to do that. Of course, any type of a anti-tank weapon or something like that would do, will do quite well against a civilian car with a bomb in it, or even something like a semi-truck. The ones that are the scariest, I think, are the ones that happened in Europe a couple Christmases ago, where, you know, the terrorist steals basically a semi and just drives it into the Christmas market crowd, you know. I don't know that there's any real way that you can stop that. You can eventually stop it and kill the driver, but it's going to inflict a lot of casualties and be very, very difficult. Okay, and that's kind of related to our next question, which is, are there any genuinely effective one-man anti-tank weapons? Well, it's been a long time since I've actually fooled with anti-tank weapons, even though I'm a former infantry guy and everything else. I will say, yes, there are. On a military scale, there are. There were two types of anti-tank weapons that always kind of were in parallel. One was repurposed small artillery pieces, like in World War I, you would see they would take something like a French 75 or something, and they would repurpose it, make a kind of a direct fire anti-tank gun out of it. Reasonably effective, not very mobile, but reasonably effective if you got the right place. You know, if you had it pointed in the right direction and a tank kind of was starting to lumber by, you could move it around and shoot it and hit it with a couple holes. I believe the French Renault 17 tank in the World War I Museum in Kansas City was hit by a 75 or 77, German 77 millimeter cannon that had been repurposed and used in the anti-tank role. And it still has the damage on it. It's still there. So I believe that was the first type. The second type were projectile weapons like rifles. And, you know, the German 13 millimeter giant, it looks like a big Mauser rifle on steroids, and fired a 13 millimeter shell, which is roughly just a little bit larger than 50 caliber. And so they had that, and in response to that, I think countries before World War II all developed something like that. The British developed the 55 caliber Boys anti-tank rifle, you know, fed with box magazine. These things were usually bolt action. The U.S. actually did something a little different. In between the wars, the M250 caliber was a primary anti-tank weapon. Because, frankly, you know, tanks in those days had shitty, thin armor. So they could stop rifle bullets, but bigger bullets they couldn't stop. Now, World War II comes around, and very, very quickly into the war, tanks have got armor so thick that you just can't count on a projectile to penetrate the armor. So those kind of weapons became very less used and more scarce. They still kind of hung around because even if an anti-tank weapon won't stop a tank, there's all kinds of other things on the battlefield besides tanks, and none of them are quite as good as tanks. So you have armored cars and scout cars and even light tanks, or in those days they had tankettes, which were like some stupid little two-man thing that they drove around. You know, you had Bren gun carriers, all these kind of little things that were floating around, half tracks. All these things are floating around on the battlefield. Now, just because your anti-tank weapon won't knock out a Panther or Tiger doesn't mean that it won't do some pretty severe damage to one of these lesser vehicles. So a lot of those anti-tank weapons hung around. But in World War II, they really went to the projectile explosive type anti-tank weapons. And some of those, you know, the bazooka was one of the best ones, and actually the Germans copied it and made Panzerfaust and Panzerschrecks, you know, same kind of deal. And really all of that kind of developed into the RPG of today. The British had a thing called a Piat. A Piat. I shouldn't laugh. It was a Piat. And the Piat, I think, had some big honking spring in it. And, you know, The problem with it, it had a big spring and it kind of lobbed this anti-tank shell out. And you know, if you hit a tank with it, I think the shell was big enough, it would actually damage a tank. The key was this thing only had about a 30-yard range. And if you know something about tanks, first of all, you rarely see a tank alone. Tanks operate in pairs or in foursomes. And so even if you can sneak within 30 yards or 30 meters of a tank, other tanks may see you and may shoot you because they have in those days, they had bow machine guns. They had a lot of machine guns on tanks because they knew that they would have people around them trying to knock them out. So they had bow machine guns, and they also had a coaxial machine gun, which all they have to do is point the main cannon at you, and they fire a machine gun that's pointed along the same axis as the main cannon, as opposed to firing the main gun round. So, you know, tanks are not only do they have a lot of thick armor, they're fast, they have good optics, but they also had a lot of machine guns, and a lot of the crew members were peering out of, you know, little vision blocks looking for anybody who's trying to knock them out. So, but anyway, these explosive type weapons were much more effective. They developed into, you know, the M72A2 anti-tank weapon, light anti-tank weapon, the RPG-7, RPG-18s, and the, what's the one they use now? They tried to develop one called a Viper back in the 80s, but that didn't really work. So then they got the AT-4. I think they bought that from somebody else. But they're all essentially a tube that fires some sort of explosive rocket. They're all the same. The only real difference with the RPG is they got the warhead on the outside, and it operates a little bit differently, but it's still the same principle, same result. One guy basically can, if he's close enough, he can hit a tank and do it some damage. The key is getting close enough. No, the key isn't getting close enough. The key is getting close enough and living to tell about it. That's the real key. That's the real key. Because the minute you do that, you're going to have a swarm of attention drawn your way. So they've always been kind of high-risk weapons to use. So there are effective AT weapons that one man can carry, and even if they don't knock out the primary tank of the enemy, they still have a whole bunch of uses against bunkers, against all kinds of things. But the explosive charge really took over for the penetrating rounds because they can do so much more damage with a hit. So that's kind of the real deal on AT weapons there, that yes, there are, and there are effective ones, but they'll probably be giving the medals to your next of kin if you actually have to use one. Okay, here's our next question. And this is an interesting question. Why did the Army replace the 9mm Beretta M9 with a 9mm SIG M17? Why did they do that? It doesn't seem that there is a tremendous increase in capability or effectiveness by doing that. Okay, I think that's a very fair question, and the answer is nobody I know of could really answer that. Here are my guesses, and these are educated guesses, but there's no guarantee that they're correct. The first one was there are probably a lot of Beretta pistols that are ending their life cycle. These aren't 1911s. Remember, they've got the aluminum frame. And just like anything else, they wear out. They can wear out. We've also been through, you know, it seems amazing, but it's been almost 20 years of continuous conflict with the war on terror, and a lot of people get deployed. It's much different than the Cold War, where we had people who were, you know, kind of in these forward deployed positions and just kind of doing the things they were doing. So, you know, it's been a lot more, the military's been a lot more active. So, the next thing is, the Beretta never had a great reputation. And part of this is, it's not really racist, it's more like the confidence in weapons building and where it comes from. People just think that Italy does not have very high quality in some ways, and that if you buy an Italian-made pistol, it's going to have less quality than a U.S.-made pistol or a German-made pistol. You know, that's just the way people think. The way people think, they think that the best weapons on the planet are either made here or they're made in Germany. That's just the way a lot of people think. Now, that wasn't true, because the Beretta outperformed a whole lot of other pistols. I think the Colt, I don't even know if Smith & Wesson entered it, but I think Colt had one in there, and it completely disintegrated. So the Beretta was really, it's a brilliant design, a very, very good gun. And when you actually test it, it comes out pretty well. It comes out pretty well. It tied the SIG, the SIG P226, the tricked out version for the U.S. military of that was. So it basically tied that and won on price. You know, won because you could buy Berettas cheaper than you could SIGs. That's just the way it goes. So that's pretty interesting, and that's the reason they chose the Beretta. The Beretta never had a great reputation. It's a little bit thick in the grip, and as you have smaller statured soldiers, i.e. bringing in a increasing number of, say, females into your force, that was not the optimal handgun for somebody with small hands. I have kind of medium small hands, and I have no real problem with it, but I've seen other soldiers who have smaller hands than I do, and I don't think they like it very much. I don't think they like that thick grip very much. So it did not inspire a lot of confidence that way. So it never had a great reputation. There weren't a lot of people wedded to it. And plus, you know, like everything else, they're influenced by police. When they first started talking about replacing the Beretta, it was funny. They thought the Army would adopt the U.S. military through the Army. The Army tests, you know, usually the ground combat stuff. They thought they'd go with 40 Smith & Wesson, which now 40 Smith & Wesson is as dead as a duck. I mean, you can buy the used police guns anywhere. Still think they're a good buy. I do. But you can get those. 9mm is just the way it's going to go. So, yes, they dumped one 9mm, replaced it with another. And I don't even really know if they tested the two against each other to see if there was really a difference. To my mind, there's not a big difference. To my mind, it comes down to life cycle. And if you sit there and say, I want to buy Berettas again, I need to replace a whole bunch of Berettas, you're going to have them for another 30 years, which means you're going to have a 60-year-old design in 30 years, or actually older, probably. I think that Beretta came out actually 40 years ago. Whereas the SIG is a comparatively new design. It's got all the bobbles and the stuff they're looking for. It's got a good trigger pull. It does have a thumb safety. It's got, you know, it's got all that kind of stuff. It's striker fired. So, you know, but that design is going to be in 30 years. It's still going to be a very current design. And by the, in 30 years from now, who knows what we're going to see? We may not. DASA autos may be very, very passe by then. So I think that was part of the reasoning. There was always the background claptrap that, you know, we owed Italy a favor. And, of course, the reasons for that vary. One of them was so we could put cruise missiles there. Another one was for some other reason that we owed them a favor, and that's why we adopted their pistol. And it was never beloved by the troops. The Beretta was never beloved. I have actually a very high opinion of the Beretta. I came from the biggest doubter, thinking, how could you indeed replace the 1911? How dare you replace it with this thing? And I wanted nothing to do with it. But once I actually shot it, got familiar with it and everything, I do give it credibility. It is a very, very good weapon. So they got rid of a very good weapon, and I think they've replaced it with a very good weapon. So it's kind of a zero-sum game on that. Okay, next question. Have you seen the Ruger 5.7x28 pistol, and if so, what do you think of it? Well, I haven't seen one in the flesh. I've seen the FN version. I've never really fired the pistol version. I fired the whatever that other thing is. The it's kind of the bullpup, another one of these bullpup things, the PS90 or whatever that is, the individual, whatever that is. I fired that. I mean, it's okay. I would never choose it for anything other than, hey, this is cool. Anything other than a range toy or, hey, this is very cool, I would never choose it for. I mean, it offers to me no advantages. You have this rifle caliber performing type cartridge in a handgun, which is limited by your ability to shoot a handgun well. So maybe let's say you're even a great shot. You know, what is your range limitation? I would say with most shooters I see, if they can hit a man-sized target with that at 50 yards, they would be doing exceptionally well. And that's just hitting, you know, kind of angle of man, just hitting the one of our famous B-27 silhouettes. I think they could probably pepper that thing, but I don't know that you're going to see tight groups or anything else. So, you know, there you go. And you're shooting kind of a 5.7, which is a, you know, just a shade larger than a 22. I don't really know what it's going to do, other than being cool. And it does have a cool factor. And actually, Ruger, who's not known for putting a lot of style into their firearms, yeah, that's an unfair thing to say, but it is actually kind of true. Their firearms aren't ugly. They just aren't beautiful. You know, I've always loved the Black Hawk revolvers, but, you know, frankly, the Black Hawk revolver looks a little different. It's not a Colt single action. It's not quite as sleek. It's tough. It's built and it's tough. Same thing with their double action revolvers. They're not ugly, but they're not really beautiful things. I mean, they're not something that they're not Colt Pythons, that's for sure. So, you know, Ruger, it does have a cool kind of very modern look, which is something you don't really see in Ruger, especially auto pistols, thinking of the P-89 and some of these other ones where, you know, I hate to say it, but people buy guns on looks, just like cars. People buy on looks. And that's one of the reasons that Ruger has always kind of taken third place behind Colt and Smith & Wesson and a few other, and those kind of designs, anyway. So, but it looks very cool. Looks like it's actually going to be reasonably priced. I think it's 500 and something bucks MSRP, which means it'd probably be a little cheaper somewhere else. I don't know how popular it'll be. I would think that if you're a Ruger collector, I would buy one because my gut feeling is it's not going to be around long. It's going to be kind of like the Ruger Hawkeye and the 357 Maximum and a few other things that Ruger's made, that the original 44 Magnum carbine. Some of these original guns that are very cool, but they don't seem to last very long, and they kind of go out of production, and they kind of become these kind of cult classics that people who like Rugers like. So this, I don't know, this is looking and smelling just like that. So I would say the time to get one is now, because I think it'll be a collector's item in fairly short order. You know, one of the things they could do, which would be smart, and gun companies don't usually do the smart thing, I would have introduced a PC carbine in the same caliber at almost the same time. You know, they tried that with the wonderful P-95 or the P-89 pistol. That and the original Ruger PC carbine were kind of made to be, well, you got two guns, they use the same magazines, one's a pistol, the other's a rifle, and you can kind of use it as a patrol carbine, you know, type of deal. They tried to sell that, it didn't work. And so this may be the same thing. They probably should have done it and brought it back. So anyway, I've seen it, and it's going to be a collector's item. Well, that's it for this edition of Old School Guns. And remember, hit like, follow, whatever you can, and follow us, and we will be a lot more popular. So until next time, this is Old School Guns, out.